We've been asked by a number of people if we could talk about a possible proof of the existence of God. Because at this moment in history, church leaders seem to be very doubtful about it. They're doubtful about the virgin birth, they're doubtful about the resurrection, they're doubtful about the incarnation. And God is such an abstraction that nobody really attempts to prove his existence. So we're going to put forward something that must be seen to be a proof of anything whatever that a human being wishes to prove. The word prove and probe have the same root. To prove is simply to probe, to investigate, to use with reason, PR, pi ratio, reason in the house, probe, reason in the house. Now we, human beings, are the house that has to be probed. We can't probe outside ourselves without probing inside. We have an external world. We believe we have because of our sense organs telling us about impressions received. And we have an internal world which is more or less correspondent with the external world. If it were totally non-correspondent, it would be utterly useless. Now, we have mentioned before that a dualism is ultimately impossible. In case there are any babies or caterpillars new in the audience, we will go over this proof because it is absolutely basic. Dualism means two causes of reality, and the two are utterly alien. They have no points of correspondence, no ways of communication in a dualism. Now, one of the dualisms offered by certain thinkers is the dualism of mind and matter, or sometimes spirit and body. Mind means consciousness engaged in an evaluating process, on that same basis man, to count, to evaluate. Body is the object of the counting. So the mind and the body are considered by dualists to be utterly alien to each other. Body is tangible, occupying space. Mind is intangible and does not occupy the same space as body in such dualisms. Now we want to go very carefully and slowly to see that an ultimate dualism is utterly impossible. A dualism in which two beings were utterly alien, with no points of correspondence, could not possibly interact. Can we see this? Are there any dissenters? Two somethings, utterly alien, with no points of correspondence, could not interact. Now if we take the naive dualism, mind and body, do our minds and bodies interact? They do. Because we can think about what we are doing. I wave my hand and I think I'm waving my hand. There is correspondence. But if there is correspondence, there cannot be an absolute, ultimate alienation of one from the other. There cannot be an ultimate difference, an ultimate lack of correspondences. So, if mind interacts with body, there cannot be an ultimate difference between them. Mind and body must be two aspects of one ultimate fact. Are we agreed about that? Would Peter like to complain about it? No? No, good. If Peter agrees, it's okay. He's our yardstick, our cubit, our Egyptian inch whereby we test everything. Peter, of course, means a stone, and the stone in small is called calculus, and to count carefully is to be petrified. That is to become very clear, to take whatever that is and define it and cut it into the minutest bits, and then to examine the qualities of all the bits. But if the bits can interrelate, they cannot be absolutely out of relation with each other. So if there are two primordial particles and they relate, those two cannot be ultimately different, so they are necessarily two modalities or modifications or expressions of a primary fact behind both. Now we're going to pass from that simple non-dualism to this question of God. How do we define God as infinitely powerful, wise, active? We say God is power, form, function. Power, that which pushes itself about. Form, that which shapes itself. Function or activity, that which causes it to express itself in the actual world of phenomena. Power, form, function. As a mnemonic, you make the sign of power, the manual of power. You hold your little finger and ring finger down, and you hold the other three up, and on the thumb you place power, on the index finger form, on the middle finger activation or function or actualization. Power, form, function. When you make that sign, it's called the manual of power. It is to remind you of this fact. Now, you cannot have an absolute dualism. So if power can interact with form, or the will with an idea, then they cannot ultimately be different. If the power and the idea can go into actuality, then actuality is not different from power form, or formulated power. Now, when we define God in infinite terms. We say he is infinitely powerful, infinitely wise, infinitely active. We say he is omnipotent, on your thumb, omniscient, on your index finger, and omnipresently active, on your middle finger. He is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. Now, if he were not those three, he would not be worth calling God. If we had a little God with no power, but knew things and could do nothing about it, we'd say, that is not a God worthy of our respect. If we had a God that was actual, activating, and had no intelligence and no will, we'd say that's not a fit God. If we had form with no power and no actualization, we would say that is not a worthwhile God. So when human beings are talking about a God worthy of the respect of human beings, that God must have whatever the human being has, but raised to infinity. Now, what has man got? He has a certain amount of power, which he expresses in self-mobility, a certain amount of intelligence, which he expresses in rational arguments, in formal explanations of things, and he has a certain amount of actualization. He can do things. So man has, in finite degree, power, form, function, or will, idea, activation. Now, does man originate himself, or does he appear in a world already operative as power, as form, as function? Do we come into a world that is already actual or not? We know we do. Let's be very careful. We cannot have a dualism. Now, our power, our will, interacts with other wills of human beings, of animals, of plants, and so on. We all agree with that, don't we? Our power, our will, can interact with other wills. And a dualism is disallowed. Impossible. So, if we define God as the will power, which is infinite, which we call omnipotent, then we have to say that because will can interact, the will of man and the will of that which we call God must be able to interact. And if man has a formulative capacity that we call reason or logos, then that reason must be correspondent in essence, and not different from, and not alienated from, the same formative power in the infinite. And if man is able to actualize himself in any way whatever, then his actualization possibility must interrelate with the actualization possibility of that power which produced the universe. So in these three, we must say that we have correspondence with that which we worship as God. The word worship means worth, shape. Now the human being is so constituted that he has designed for himself the concept of a God. So that many skeptics say, well, God is just the idea that a man has of an omnipotent superior being, a superman with super intelligence and super activation power. Well, let's examine this one. Everything that man has is derivative. Every man or woman born of woman is derivative. He derives from the ovum of the mother, the sperm of the father, and the environment of the body, the recipient body of the mother. Everything he does, everything he thinks, everything he wills is derivative. Now, let's hold this. Dualism is impossible, and our derivative nature means that we are part of that infinite power, infinite form, infinite activation. We cannot be other than derivative. Dualism is impossible, and therefore that from which we are derivative and ourselves cannot ultimately be different. Now let's have a little light on the dark subject. Let the light that you see on the screen stand for consciousness. Light has always been, in every major religion, every major philosophy, a symbol of consciousness. The power whereby we can see what is, see form functioning. See evidences everywhere that there is power formally functioning. And that whereby we know this is called consciousness. The light represents consciousness. Would you like to have the phonetics of light to show that it is so? Alright, we'll put it down. L. Now L means to labour, to work. In the Hebrew it's lamed, means an ox goad, a provocation to activity. I means the individuation. I, the individuation, the yod, the jot that Jesus talks about, that shall not pass away till all is fulfilled. The individuation fact. Each one of us is an individual. Each one of us is unique. Even twins, even so-called identical twins, differ in characteristics. They come out of the same egg, they are nurtured in the same womb, they come out and they are manifestly different individuals. One is born before the other and is characterized by that fact for the rest of its life. One was above and the other below, one was on the left, the other on the right, in that womb. Everything about it is uniquely characterizing. And the letter I signifies precisely that. Originally that I, a line, was a little dot. And because of impurities in the paper or the papyrus on which we recorded this, it was decided that wherever we had a dot, it might be a little dropping of a fly or it might be an impurity in the paper, we'd better put a line under it to show that it was a dot. And that is why we said, and some Greek scholars have said, the Greeks are very intelligent, they don't dot their I's, they put their I without the dot. Now they've got it upside down. The dot is the I, and this straight line is the indicator of the dot, to show that it is a dot on a piece of paper, and not an impurity in the paper. Now, the hard letter G, gamma, the gimel of the Hebrew, that hard letter G means compaction. It means condensation. It means power driving into its center to make itself solid. So when I've written the word link, I've written a word which you all recognize as a basic of the word ligature and religion, binding. I stimulate an individual to condense, link. Now, if I say the hard G represents originally before lazy people existed, a letter that had to be pronounced. So in the old days they would say lig for that. In English, when we see it followed by H and T, we drop it. Why? Because it's a difficult letter to pronounce. You have to block your mouth at the back with the raised up tongue in a g. Isn't it difficult to say g? Wouldn't it be more economic if we said, well, don't bother to say it. Just write it. You know, lig is another word for lie, isn't it? In certain dialects, you say, he's a terrible ligger. Yes, you know that one? Does nobody know that ligger means liar? And it's an old English base. What's the word in German for lying? It's in German now. Abel? Isn't it the same word, disguised a little bit? Lüge. A liar is anybody who ties up or binds an individual into a compact state. Later we'll see that that is the only sin, to separate by condensation the consciousness from the infinite light or consciousness of the absolute. There is only one sin, to identify with finitude. You put an H here, and that's an aspirate. And we will treat this as one sound, namely a hard gamma with an aspirate on it. So we used to say once upon a time, lich, and it was a bit difficult. So we said, well, drop this sound. It's a hard sound to make. We will then put a T there, and that T signifies the crossing or crucifixion of the forces which have involved themselves in that compact zone there. Now, if we change this IGH into the German ICH, what does that mean, Abel? It's I, the principle of individuation, I-hood. If we then put the L back and the T back, we've written the German word for light, Licht, for consciousness. We cannot have consciousness without Ich, without this impedance of the field by itself, self-condensing. There is a word that means I in modern German, and there is a word that means I in old English Germanic root. That is light, that is consciousness. Now, we know that our bodies are derivative, don't we? From mothers and fathers. And we know that they are all derivative backwards from their mothers and fathers and so on. And they were derivative from the primordial powers that condense hard gamma as the earth, that the forces of infinite power form function condensed to make the star system, the planetary system, the earth on which we live. We are derivative. So where do we derive? The answer is we derive from the infinite power which produced the stars, which produced the planetary system, which produced the planets, one of which is the earth on which we live. We are derivative at every level on prior power form function. Now the infinite power form function is the one we call God, and we call it God because God is good, good is God. In the German, God ist gut, and gut, good ist Gott. See, that's the same expression. Now we are derivative. In our power, that is our will, in our form, that is our intellect, in our function, that is our actualization capacity. And we cannot be dualistic, so we have to say that ourselves and our derivatives and our sources are all ultimately non-dualistic. We are functions or modalities of that supreme infinite power that we call God. That's why one of the apostles said, I am persuaded that nothing can separate us from the love of God. We cannot be separated from our source. That dualism is impossible, and because we are derivative, we are derivatives of an absolute power, form, function. The supreme will, that is power, the supreme all-knowingness, which in man is intellect, and self-actualization. And when we remember our derivative nature and thoroughly understand that we are derivative from that power, that intelligence, that actualization that created the system of the stars, the solar system, the planets, and our earth, and all the life forms, vegetable, animal, human, upon the earth, we cannot disbelieve in our derivative nature. We cannot disbelieve that there is that from which we derive, and we cannot help disbelieving in an ultimate dualism. Therefore, we are, each one of us, sitting on our own chair, an impression, a pressing in, an impressing of that infinite original power from which we derive. Now this is why Jesus says, is it not written, ye are gods. And God is defined as a self-volitional, self-determinant, self-knowing, self-actualizing being. Any being that is actually self-knowing, self-determinant, is by definition a god. And the supreme infinite from which all those little gods derive is called the God. In the Gospel of John, it has Theos, the God, not just a God, the God, the God of gods. Now we are all little gods. That is to say, we have a will, we have intelligence, we have actualization of our being, and that constitutes our divinity. Are there any non-gods? Are there any bipeds walking about who are not gods? Well, the answer is actually yes. How so? Because of this fact. When two beings meet like that, there is a zone of contingent, that means we touch, stimulation, such that the stimulus of either can obscure the state of the other. Supposing this one is uniquely A and that one is uniquely B, well then where they meet, the A tends to impose on the B, and the B to impose on the A, and they tend to do what we call identifying. The A identifies with the stimulus from B and forgets that it is A. The B identifies with the stimulus from A and forgets that it is B. Now we are only actual gods if we remember that we are willed, self-determinant, intelligent, self-activated. If we forget that and let somebody else, by contingent stimulus, by touch, stimulate us and drag us outside our skin, we lose in act our divinity. We become enslaved by the contingent stimulus. And that is called the fall. The fall is a fall into contingency. Now let's remember that the light represents consciousness. What do these circles represent? They represent zones of perception, zones of interest. We are all interested in something, and that something could either be our own self or other than ourself. Now if we're interested in ourself truly, then a being self-interested would turn its energies into itself like that. All its energies would go in like that. That would be an entirely self-interested being. That's one kind of interest. The other kind is the interest in other beings through two-way continuous stimulation. The interest in two-way continuous stimulation is very dangerous because it can cause A to forget A and think itself B. You saw that when princes die, emerged in the public eye with her hair done like this, and immediately millions of women rushed to the hairdresser and came out like this. And that was identification. We call it a manifestation of stupidity. Why did they all rush off and do their hair in that way? Because unconsciously, that means not in full awareness, they all thought, if I get my hair done like that already, I could have married Prince Charles. Do you believe it? It's true. Somebody with exceptionally bad taste in the royal family can go out and have a dress designed for them by some idiot, put it on, appear in public, and immediately fashion is created. Why? Because of the unconscious mental processes whereby, through contingent stimulus, an ordinary person suddenly thinks, my word, if I'd have thought of that first, I could have been a princess. Do you believe it? Do you feel ashamed of it when you think of the danger? That you might think, all I have to do is wear this or that, and I can change my social status. I can move up from scrubber to prince. Do you believe it? It happens every day, and billions of pounds are spent in advertising to reinforce it. So that's one terrible danger, the danger of identification with the alien. The opposite danger is this, that in self-turning inwards, it is possible to forget that there is anything other than this zone which turns in on itself and doesn't want to know that there are other zones in the infinite. And this we call the demonic. It turns in upon itself. The D is for division and the mon is for counting. It divides itself from the rest of reality and turns in upon itself, and it is then demonic. It doesn't want to know about anything except itself, internal to itself, no other being, and no infinite light, no Godhead, no supreme infinite intelligence, just myself, locked in myself. The extreme form of that is called solipsism, where a person believes that he and he alone exists and the rest of you are figments of his imagination. One evening a fellow brought a girl with him here and introduced her to me as a solipsist. And I put my hand out and shook hands and said, oh, that's good, so am I. Well, that couldn't be true, could it? So she never came again. On one occasion, another fellow at the university boasted he was a solipsist. That meant we were all figments of his imagination. So I tapped him on the shin bone with my foot. And he said, what did you do that for? I said, not the faintest idea. Why don't you control your figments better? So we have two terrible dangers. The danger of identifying with Princess Di's hairdo. And the danger of total self-involvement, the demonic isolated in a world of one's own. We see an approximation to this in the autistic child. You know, maybe you've seen an autistic child, have you? Totally involved, usually they're in a hospital. And they don't come out, they don't respond. They're locked, from whatever causes, in their own mental processes. Now remember, dualism is impossible. Every power we have of will, of thought, of action is derivative. And being derivative can interact with that from which it derives. That from which it derives is infinite power, infinite form, infinite function, and that is God. And therefore we, human beings, can interact with God. And we have two dangers. One, contingency. You meet an atheist. An atheist said to me on one occasion, "I'm an atheist." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "There is no God." And I said, "What is that which there is not? Can you explain to me what it is that is not?" And he became a bit confused. "Would you try to explain to me that which is not? And it's something I don't believe in. What is it?" "It's God." "What's God?" "That in which I do not believe." "But in not believing in it, you've objectified it. It's become a thing. What are the qualities of this thing?" "Well, omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence. I don't believe in it." "Well, do you believe that your eye looking out millions of light years away can see a star?" "Oh yes, I've seen one of those." "Then your awareness field must at least be as big as that sphere which includes the stars that you can see. And can you see beyond that star into the darkness? Are you aware of the darkness beyond the stars? Is that darkness not already inside your consciousness as darkness?" "Oh well, that's only a concept." "Only a concept." The word concept means to capture. Concept. The set part of the word means to capture. That which you capture together is a concept. "Well, do you not capture darkness? Have you not been unconscious? Have you ever had a general anesthetic or a thump on the head which made you forget who you are for a moment? Do you not go to bed at night and go to sleep? And sometimes when you're asleep, you do not dream. You're in a dreamless sleep. But when you wake up in the morning, do you not know that you had a good night or a bad night? Everybody knows whether they had a good night or a bad night. Now that means that whatever it is that's awake during the daytime, when he goes to sleep, he's still mysteriously there. It only needs a certain change in its function," said Paul. "Its function, the way its power behaves, and it becomes itself again. How dare we go to sleep and have a terrible courage? Why aren't we afraid that tomorrow we wake up a dragon or a lizard or a butterfly? Isn't that a dreadful real danger? Every night when I go to sleep, I put my head on a cushion and think, supposing I wake up in the morning and I'm a girl. Perhaps I'd better hang on to my concept." I said to a boy yesterday, he said he had no identity. "Are you a boy or a girl?" "Not to be tingled." He said, "I'm a man." "You don't want to be a boy." "I'm a man." "Okay, very good, he's a man." Had he not identified himself with the concept man at that moment? Now, man is an interesting word. Let's have a bit of man word. M means substance. Now, there is no substance other than the light of consciousness. Substantia, that which is standing underneath all that we know, is an infinite field of powerful conscious activity. That is the meaning of the M. But when we pronounce M, we close our lips, don't we? At least I tend to. Will you try to say M with an open mouth for me? Can't you manage it better? Oh, what a terrible limitation. Well, if we do manage it, we say, we have closed ourselves. How do we close ourselves? The answer is, we take any zone, whatever of light, and we surround it with a definition. And if we circumscribe it with words, we say, this is the zone of my operation. Z1. The zealous unification of my intent to be a being. And I'm going to close my lips and go, You know when you say, like that, like bees humming, you're really thinking honey to yourself. I'm my honey. Rosie, you are my posy. And you're thinking of yourself and you're yum, yum, yum. The word yum means affirmation of substance. The substance is you. is your very own being. The substance of God is God, his very own being. What he is light infinite, power infinite, activity infinite. What we are is power, form, activity, and relatively limited, but only by one thing, our identification. The atheist doesn't prefer not to be God. Can you tell me why an atheist doesn't want to be God? He doesn't want the responsibility of having to be kind to his mother-in-law, does he? Or perhaps even to his wife. If we are God, have we not the imperative, the moral, the ethical duty to take care of our creatures which we make? Can we dodge responsibility for the things we create? No. So, to be a God is to be responsible. Who likes it? Answer. Not capitalists. Not materialists. Not those people that hate ethical responsibility. And we are all power, form, function, a will, an intellect, and self-activation capacity. And we create things. When we create, we are under the duty of taking care of what we create. If you doodle on a napkin in a restaurant, do you throw the doodle away carelessly? Have you no consideration for the doodle? You say, bah, a mere doodle. On the foot. Down with doodle. Or do you secretly think, my doodle, rather good that. I know a man came to see me one day, and he'd done a doodle. I'll show you the doodle. He's a very worried businessman. He went like this. I want you to interpret this for me. He said, I'm terribly sorry, I can't stop doing this. And I feel absolutely awful. So I said, how do you feel now? He said, a bit better. The doodle was an expression of his internal process. And would you believe that doodle and deodle means God? You know what a doodle zach is? Bagpipe. I'll draw you a bagpipe. You care which way up it is. Here's a bag. Yeah? Does that do for the bag? Not bad, is it? And here's a pipe. What does Dudelsack mean in German, Abel? Yes, and what is it a symbol of in Germanic art? In, say, Bosch? It's a sign of sensual basic rudery. It looks a bit like it, too. Now, in Egypt, they said, well, we want something to stop it. We've got the crux ansata, the symbol of life. Why do we put that crossbar on it? Well, if you're not careful, this pipe will vanish in the sack. Do you know that the appetite of women is infinite and the capacity to satisfy it by men is finite? So we need a stopper. What? So that crux ansata, that crux, the crux of the matter, that word belongs down there. And this is the ansata, the handle. Now what is the handle? An means snake and sata means being. Shift the end to the end, satam. Is it not through womankind that we come into birth? If it were not that there are women through which come to birth, wouldn't we have to wander in infinity like spirits with no home? Can you see it? Unless we gain finite birth in bodies, we are vapors, we are wandering spirits in infinity. So coming to be born is very important for that process of identification which we as humans value so much. Remember, the light is our consciousness. Anything we draw upon this sheet is a content. That means with holding. We hold our consciousness to a point. Here is one by Pythagoras. Primary point, one. Spelt with three letters. Whether we say one, or ein, or yin, or uno, we spell one with three letters. Why? Because one is power, one is form, one is function. We can't have a one that is not a triplicity. So, in ancient Egypt, where Pythagoras spent 22 years studying, like Moses did in the same place, and Jesus did in the same place, and Plato and all kinds of Greek thinkers went there for a holiday, like Butlin's camp, to learn deep things for high de high. One begets two. That means when you look at the one, you see immediately two. Why? Because the one is finite and confined to a point, and the other one is the infinite light or consciousness beyond it. Already there's two. But we want to represent the infinite one beyond finitely, so we say, okay, one of them is the point, and the other represents the consciousness beyond the point. One begets two, and two begets three. How? Because when we have one, you'd polarize, that's two, that's the Trinity. And the two halves, the one here precipitate, and the one non-precipitate infinite beyond, have a relation, so we have three. That and that are related. And three begets four. Why four? Well, there is a one, there is a two, there is a three, and there is a four. Four has always meant consolidation in the earth. Because we get two forces opposing each other, and two at right angles to those, and it makes solidity. Four has been the number of the earth, the number of solidity. In Kabbalah, the fourth Sephira is solid God. Chesed, compassion, mercy, Jupiter. Jupiter is Jupiter, Dio, Pater, God the Father. The first three-dimensional God. So Lao Tse would say one begets two begets three begets everything. Now, in counting, Pythagoras would say, please count for me this symbol. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You say, no. Count this way. 1 plus 2 equals 3. And this 3 plus the original 1, of which those two are polarizations, makes 4, which is a solid. And we now put them together. Here is the 4, which is the earth. And resting upon it are two columns, Boaz, Yakin, and a triangular roof on top in the symbol of the primordial dot. Now you can find this diagram on Gnostic gems of the 2nd century, and it represents Solomon's temple. Why? The name of one column means strength, the name of the other to establish. Both together, stability. Primordial idea, representative of power, form, function, the duality springing out of it of opposing forces, because every force that's posited opposes its origin and any subsequent force, and then the gross establishment on which all stands. Now we've got to see that earth as the center on which we live, like that, and we've got to see the poles like that, and we've got to see the triangle like that in which they are, and we can see immediately that this dot here represents this dot and the Earth. Our earthly body is the compaction of our spirit. Compacted spirit is physical body. Just as our bodies are uniquely chemically different, so our spirit is rationally different. And that symbol is very, very simple. And it's said to be a drawing of Solomon's temple. Now you remember that we have four levels of meaning: a literal level, allegorical level, homiletic, and mystical. Now, as far as this drawing would be concerned, literally, it would be a structure made like that. You'd find a piece of rock, flatten the top, put a couple of columns on it, put a triangular pyramidal roof on it, and put the sign of the sun on the facade. And it really existed like that in ancient Greece, the basis of Greek architecture. And it really existed like that in Egypt, in Babylonia, in India, in China. They built it this way. And it was a physical fact. But when the priests who designed it looked at it, did they think it meant a physical fact only? Or did they think it meant an allegory? Allegory means other reading. This is the earth on which we stand. These two columns are one my right hand of power, one my left arm of cunning. We are beings of power and cunning, of will and intellect. The triangle represents that which synthesizes our power, form, function. And the little solar globe there represents our primary initiative. We've now got an allegory. Are we satisfied with it? Well, we want to make a fraternity of Freemasons, of people who all believe they derive from one mother. They are sons of primal Ma, Ma's sons. And the woman of which they all derive means universal substance. And now we're going to make a homily out of it. You are all people. Amazing, isn't it? You all stand on the earth, and you all have power and intelligence. And this is the homily part. I call upon you as fellow sons of the Eternal Mother to cooperate and triangle, to unify and to have initiative and make a wonderful cooperative society. That's homily. Homily is that which you address to a mass of people that tend, if you're not careful, to take things literally or misunderstand the allegory. So you're going to tell them, all this means be kind to each other. Use your initiative to unify your three parts, power, form, function, head, heart and tongue. Remember, you've got strength in your right arm and cunning in your left arm. And use your strength to defend each other and your cunning to get each other out of mischief. Cunning means educate. Filled with ideas. That's homily. I remember when we entered the European market, one bright politician stood up and said, "The British people have expressed their desire and will to enter the common market." How did he know that? Wasn't it just homily? The British people won't get a good cup to drink. He must have been in the pub that night. You don't remember doing it, but he says with great conviction. That funny fellow that's a spare time conductor makes funny remarks like that. That's homily. Now the mystical meaning. Mystical meaning. Now that comes from a word meaning to keep your mouth shut. Keep a secret. Don't tell anybody. The mystical meaning is this. These 10 points are the same 10 points that occur in the Tree of Life in the Kabbalah, appearing as 10 sephiroth, spheres of being, or zones of influence, or levels of consciousness. And this represents our physicality, And these two columns represent our willpower and our cunning, our intelligence. And this triangle represents our ability to coordinate our thinking and feeling and willing. And that dot represents our power of initiative, which proves that we are divine. Suddenly this temple of Solomon means divinity. We are all divine beings. What does divine mean? Well, you know, that's the word meaning God. It occurs in the Germano-Hindu language. Sanskrit means God. It means the same thing through the Greek, and it's reduced to a J-U. Notice that D occurs, D-G-U. When you say Jew, aren't you saying D-U, quickly? Jew. Yeah? That occurs also in the Greek, but Jew, that's Div. Pater, Father. That means, who put us here? Yeah? And this means, I move threefold life. I'm divine if I can divine what corresponds with my will, my intellect, and my power of self-activation. I'm divine if I can do those three things. And if I can do them in a small way, I'm a little divinity. If I can do them infinitely, I am the big divinity. Now all yoga systems aim at making that individual point, which comes from infinity like that, turns round, that's the number six, which is the number of individuation and the number of the sun in pre-Christian religions. Why? Because we can divide it with the compass into six parts. Six. Existence. The word existence means sixfold, out of six. It turns round and it has five senses in a common sense. It's a six being. And when it does that, it has brought itself into existence. You know, the X is only a KS. Existence. And that's six. This means crucifixion, and this means essence. The essence of crucified sixness, that's that wheel, that's called the wheel of being, the wheel of existence. We exist insofar as we stand visibly, tangibly present in the middle of the infinite field. The infinite field has no edges, no circumscribing boundaries, and this being here has a circumscribing boundary whereby we know we exist. So we can say that when we think about God as existent, we are thinking about that power which captures itself. That little diagram is inside the bigger diagram like this that we call the universe. And every one of us is a little one of these. And within each one of these, there's some more little ones. Can you see that one? It's very much like an eye, isn't it? Suppose we take the Egyptian form of that, and we go like this. Don't you think that's the same diagram? It is. And to remind you that you're cunning, they curl that upon itself. And to remind you that you have direct power, they do that. And there's your Egyptian eye of Horus, of hierarchical power. You are hierarchical, that means you know that the differences of power, a non-active, non-thinking, impulsive being wastes itself. You know that a being that can't think is not formally clear, and you know that a being that can't feel doesn't get the value of what it's thinking or doing. Now this I tells you there is a winding from infinity, a turning, and a positing of a point of initiative. The name of that initiative is Pu, which means power, driving, plus pill, which means pilo or reason. Pupil, that dark center of your eye, means powerful reasoner. Now would you believe that when your eye was evolved, it actually grew out like this, in the brain, it went like this. It actually grew like that. It gripped itself like that, and that's a section to it. There's your retina, and there's that little lens. It is grasped, it is conceived, it is captured together, a world of perceptions. Can you feel in your own eye when you look out with intent to be interested that you're really a willful being? I look at you. In the act of looking, I look for something valuable. If I see nothing, I lose interest. If I see something, I want it. Essentially, the pupil is appetival. Now, the iris means rainbow, doesn't it? That's your retina there, thrown forwards, and you've got coloured pieces like this. There is your pupil, enough in the circle. Here is your iris. All the colours, which means powers, in the pupil, or precipitate centre of power reason, split and make a rainbow. The light goes through that pupil because the pupil is paying attention and dragging the light in. Do you know when you look at somebody, you eat them? You believe that? You actually start eating people. Every time you see something worth eating, you surreptitiously, spiritually pinch a bit. And that's why it's very dangerous to be admired. You could find yourself very weak through the admiration of other people. They're draining energy from you by their imagination. Do you like that? Everybody a vampire. Funny, Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, he's a friend of my father's. And in private he said, I really believe in vampires, you know. They're not fictive. Then he used to whisper, we're surrounded by them. And we also are vampires. He knew that this power to go through the pupil and look at people is a method of capturing their interest. And when you capture their interest flows out as energy towards you. Who cares about midnight movies in the presence of that fact? Now, have we understood dualism is impossible? We are all derivative, and our derivations have given us power of will, intellectual ideation, self-activation, and they're derivative. That from which they are derivative in its infinity we call God. Therefore we are all children of God. But the ch in child means chop, separate. Chop, work, divide. That's the meaning of child. Just like baby means still having to be cuddled, child means chopping off from the parents. I want my own way already. Youth means I behave like God. And mature means I've been utterly conditioned by the law. Do we consider this as sufficient proof of God? Have we not probed our derivative will, intellect, self-activation sufficiently to know that we are derivative from an infinite power of infinite intelligence, of infinite self-activation, We have participated, we got it. But we'll have more of it the more we realize our derivation from its infinite power. We grow in divinity as we absorb this fact. What is doubt? Doubleness. D-O-U-B, doubt and double is the same. It means your house divided. House B, D, division. Divide, drive the house into bits. If the sun and moon should doubt, they'd immediately go out. If you doubt your divine origin, you weaken yourself. So all atheists are weaker than true understanders of divinity. What would you like to be? A weakling or a strong being? What would you like to be? Intelligent or stupid? What would you like to be? A creature of creative initiative or one entirely dependent on external stimulus? Now if you choose the positives, you are claiming the divinity which is right in yours. Your proof to yourself, if you complete it, is infinite perspective. But if you stop halfway and wonder whether it's true, it is you doubting you, deceiving. DC means two captives. I'm not a god. I'm a miserable, finite creature. Then you doubt. Then you lose your infinite perspective. Wider. Yes. What was the question of the riddle of the Sphinx? What is it that goes on four legs in the morning, on two legs in the afternoon, three legs in the evening? You remember? Wasn't that the riddle of the Sphinx to be solved by Oedipus? You know, Oedipus means swollen foot or phallus or drive. Individual drive. And what is it that goes on four, two, and three? So they very cunningly said, oh, well, we'll fool the people with this one. We say, a baby goes on four legs when it's little. When it gets a bit bigger, it stands on two legs. And when it's an old man, it needs a stick. Well, that was a homily. The reality is the baby is a materialist. He wants to collect everything. Four is a number of tangibility. When he gets a bit older, he goes on to two. Two means analysis, division. And three doesn't mean meaning uncorrected, it means synthesis. So first an external, tangible, seeking, grasping materialist like every baby. The other babies can support themselves on a stick within an hour of being born, taken out of their mothers, and they have such tenacity of grip they can hang on. And look at little baby monkeys and their mothers are jumping about the trees. Who's doing the hanging on? The baby. The baby has this terrible tenacity, holding power, because thereby it doesn't get separated from that which is going to nourish it. Yes? Isn't that lovely? Four, two, three. Can you add those up, how many people? I like businessmen that count. You're right for a good bargain, you know. Of course, if you keep going up one at a time, you're bound to hit the right number eventually, aren't you? What is the ninth letter of the Hebrew alphabet? Any offers? And what does he mean? Serpent. The worm that dieth not. Infinite, appetival, power, intelligent, self-activation. Okay. You know number nine is called the number of the magician. Why? Because when you do an operation with nines, mathematically, You add them up. They always add up to 9, don't they? 1, 9, 2, 9, 18, 8, 1, 9, 3, 9, 27, 72, 9. It was right up. 81, 8, 1, 9. It always comes back to this. Primordial, powerful, appetival, intelligent drive. So draw your attention. I'll leave you this one thing, but a baseline. This is a serpent lying down pretending to be a rod. A book, which the serpent is reading. And an intelligent serpent, which is telling the book. If you did it very simply, you might go like this. And say, that's the serpent in an act of self-study. And what does the word nine mean? Phonetically, nine, is that? No. Nine. Negation of one. And denial of unity is nine. Why do we deny unity? We don't want to be crudely, rigidly monistic. We want to be non-dual, not rigidly monistic. All the arguments in religion are caused by somebody trying to be monistic and defining everybody else's religion as wrong. Whereas in non-dualism, they're all right. The man that leaves his own religion for the religion of another has understood neither his own religion nor the one he changes to. Because all religions are varied expressions of one supreme religion. Sentient power, form, self-activation. That is the truth behind all religion and all philosophy. And it's represented in that lovely little sign. Now this little drawing shows you an ibis-headed fellow with a beak. His name is Tilting Greek, which is a form of Egyptian Tehute, which nowadays is called technology. Know-how. Now isn't the whole pursuit of knowledge, of wisdom, a pursuit of know-how? Could it be anything else? No. In order to know how, you must examine your own being, your own thought, your own feeling, your own will, your own body. And you must incarnate all this. And when you incarnate it, you catch yourself by the tail and turn yourself into that magical serpent who has established himself by his own reflexive act. He bites his tail, the message goes round, somebody has bitten me. Was it myself or somebody else? If I think it was somebody else, I bite back in an act of revenge. And if I know that I created the condition when I got bitten, I don't bite back. So the law, don't revenge yourself, but meditate on it. How did I get in the position where this other person could bite me? It's my own stupidity that makes it possible for another person to injure me. What am I doing there at the time they injure me? Why am I there? Yes. What am I? Where am I? When am I? Yes. Why? Who am I? And how did I get into it? Yes? 5 W's and an 8. Always go through them. What am I? Where am I? Remember, wherever I am, I put myself there, either deliberately or unconsciously, or by accepting an invitation. When am I? Why am I? Who am I? A volitional being. How am I? By what manner do I become myself? The answer is by self-precipitation. Nobody is responsible for anything that happens to us. We and we alone are responsible, each one of us individually, for everything that happens to us. We stop cursing the other people because we put ourselves in a position where they could operate upon us. Do we like that? Or does it make us a bit nervous? Was I really so stupid? Answer, yes. Should I remain so stupid? Well, I might get more experiences if I do. That's called the secret of the Tower of Fool. He behaves like a fool, and he gets wised up. If ever he thought, I've been foolish enough, I will stop. At that moment he stops self-education. So we rest on that mystical drawing of technology. Modern technology is nothing but the expression of the intelligence of that divinity called Takuti, who is that mysterious ninth letter symbol, which is said to be a snake, but it's a funny kind of snake, because you know in the evolutionary scheme birds evolved from reptiles. The bird is a flying snake. You get it in some Egyptian pictures like this. Flying snake, completely wings. Quetzalcoatl, the serpent that flies in the night. We are all that. As to the wings, it means our intellect, thing of the air. As to the rigor here, it means sensuality, appetite. The volitional pursuit of that which will make us happier than we were. Counting. Yes. Well, man, of course, is ma, substance, activated. That's ma, the principle of motherhood, plus n, which is short for nous, intelligence. And through this intelligence, you control the appetite. So, somebody was not called a man in the ancient world unless he had escaped the control of his mother. If he remained under the mother's thumb, he was not called man. In the Pacific, you put an A in, mama. Now, na means serpent, and that means appetite. Mana means magical power. The power whereby you are able to nam, or name, to yourself your functions in every aspect. Human means hierarchical man. H means hierarchy, U means driving power. A man is simply being count by negating his appetite. A human is one that sets up a hierarchy of power drive. So we need to rest a little with Takuti.